first question once and for all.
Lecture 18, Scotland from Macbeth to Braveheart.
Welcome back. Last time we talked about the English invasions of Wales and Ireland. In this lecture, I'd like to tell the story of Scotland from about the 11th century to the early 14th century. I will overlap here with my lecture on the Irish Sea world that focuses on the encounter between the Scandinavians and the Celtic-speaking peoples from the 8th to the 15th centuries. Here, though, I will focus in a more concentrated way on the story of the creation of the Kingdom of Scotland, and we'll look at the role that ethnicity played in that process, particularly Celtic ethnicity. Along the way, we'll look at some of the most intriguing figures in Scottish history, Macbeth, Sir William Wallace, and Robert the Bruce. Let's recap a little before we get started. Scotland had been open to many influences over the years. You have the Celtic-speaking Picts in the northeast and the Celtic-speaking Britons in the southwest. You have the Germanic-speaking Angles in the southeast and the Germanic-speaking Scandinavians in the far north and the western islands. And everywhere else you have the Celtic-speaking Gaels who trace their cultural lineage to Ireland. So by the 9th century, Scotland is very multi-ethnic and very multilingual. It's a rather complicated picture. But then we get some streamlining. In the 9th and 10th centuries, there's an amalgamation between the areas of Pictish influence and the areas of Irish influence, and they ended up creating a unitary Scottish kingdom in the heartland of what later became Scotland, from the central belt between Edinburgh and Glasgow, up north into the Highlands. The losers in this process seem to have been the Picts, in the sense that their language and culture died out. But remember, this doesn't necessarily mean that anything terrible happened to the people. They probably just adopted a Gaelic identity. As we have seen repeatedly in this course, that kind of shift in cultural and linguistic identity has happened many times in the story of the Celtic world. Exactly how this happened, we're not sure. Later written sources place this consolidation of the Picts and the Scots during the reign of Kenneth MacAlpin, who supposedly reigned from 810 to 858. This newly consolidated kingdom slowly but surely absorbed the British kingdoms in the southwest, in the Glasgow region and in Galloway, and forced the English and the Scandinavians out. This process took many centuries, and it was rather messy. Not everybody in Scotland really wanted there to be one powerful Scottish king, and even those who did believe in a unified kingdom often disagreed very strongly about who should rule it. Enter the figure I want to begin with, Macbeth. Macbeth is certainly a famous figure due to Shakespeare's play, but I want to talk about him here because he is a perfect example of how Celtic sensibilities came to seem alien to later people who had been influenced by English political and cultural norms. Macbeth was a very Celtic ruler, but he was stigmatized later as a villain in order to make the Scottish ruling house look less Celtic and thus less barbaric. Macbeth was born around 1005 into this newly consolidated Scottish kingdom that was both facing enemies on its periphery and frequently torn by internal conflict. The main reason for the turmoil was the Scottish system of succession to the throne, which was common to other parts of the Celtic-speaking world. In 11th century Scotland, the rules were quite loose. You needed to be related to the previous king. Ideally, you would be his oldest son. But the most important factor was not your exact position in the royal genealogy. It was your competence to rule. And that was determined very much by whether you could project an image of strength to your followers. Therefore, every time a king died, the question of who would succeed him was up for debate, and usually up for dispute. It was quite common to have conflicts that pitted an uncle against a nephew, a brother against a brother, or a cousin against a cousin. So keep in mind that succession disputes in Macbeth's period were not unusual. They were normal. So let's look at the events of Macbeth's life. He was born, as I said, in 1005. He was probably the grandson of King Malcolm II through his mother, and his father was the ruler of Moray, an important territory in the north of Scotland. When King Malcolm died in 1034, the kingdom went to another grandson, Duncan, the son of King Malcolm's daughter, Bethach. Duncan and Macbeth were probably fairly close in age. Duncan ruled for 6 years, and then he was killed by Macbeth. But not as we see in Shakespeare's play. It's not a cold-blooded murder. In fact, Macbeth killed Duncan in battle. Macbeth was merely pursuing his own claim to the throne. Furthermore, that battle took place on Macbeth's home turf. Duncan had invaded Macbeth's territory in the north because Macbeth had become a threat to him. He must have been making noises about claiming the throne himself, and Duncan was trying to head him off at the pass, so to speak. So the two cousins fought each other for control of Scotland, and Macbeth won, fair and square. By the rules of the 11th century, he did nothing unusual, let alone wrong. According to our sources, Macbeth then ruled relatively successfully for 17 years, which is not what it seems like in the play. In fact, Macbeth was so secure on the throne that in 1050, 10 years into his reign, he actually went on pilgrimage to Rome, where he distributed alms to the poor. That was a big deal in the 11th century, to leave your kingdom for months at a time, but Macbeth felt able to leave the kingdom in the capable hands of his wife, Gruach. And that was her name. Maybe Shakespeare lost heart at the thought of a character named Gruach and just went with Lady Macbeth. One annal reports that the poor were well taken care of in Scotland during Macbeth's reign. This does not sound very much like the bloody tyrant we know from the play, does it? Ultimately, though, Macbeth lost the kingdom just as he had gained it, in battle with a rival, Malcolm III, son of Duncan, whose nickname was Malcolm Canmore. That means big head. There's the word cain for head that we encountered when I talked about the Celtic languages. The nickname Canmore is probably a reference not to the actual size of Malcolm's head, but to his leadership abilities. Malcolm had grown up in exile in the south in England, and he enlisted the help of the Northumbrian Earl Seward, who was his uncle, in his campaign against Macbeth. The combined Northumbrian and Scottish army did in fact meet up with Macbeth at Dunsinane, and they defeated Macbeth's army there, but that was actually not the end of the story. Macbeth retreated further north, and they did not catch up with him until several years later, when he was finally slain. It took another year, however, for Malcolm to establish himself on the throne, because Macbeth was briefly succeeded by his stepson, Lulach, the son of Gruach, by a prior marriage. Now, soon after Macbeth was killed, he was virtually forgotten, and he remained obscure for about 300 years. It's not until the 14th century that there was a sudden upsurge of interest in Macbeth. I'll return to Macbeth at the end of the lecture. But Malcolm Canmore does succeed in establishing a more or less stable dynasty. And Malcolm's reign marks the beginning of a period of English influence in Scotland that profoundly shaped the creation of the Scottish kingdom and ultimately helped to dilute the Celtic elements in Scottish politics and culture. So where did the English influence over the Scottish court come from? I already mentioned that Malcolm had regained his throne with the help of his uncle, Earl Seward of Northumbria, and that indicates that Scotland and England were by no means sealed off from each other in this period. In fact, they were always interconnected, even if they were frequently at war. For many centuries, England and Scotland harbored each other's exiles. And if England had sheltered the Scottish exile, Malcolm, then Scotland was about to shelter a famous family of English exiles, through which English mores, and then Anglo-Norman mores, would have a profound impact on Scotland. I'm going to make a rather extended digression here into English history, but I promise that it will relate very directly to Scotland. Most people have, of course, heard of the Norman conquest of England in 1066. A less well-known aspect of this conquest is the fact that even after the English king, Harold Godwinson, was killed at the Battle of Hastings, there was a royal English claimant who survived. This claimant was named Edgar Atheling. He was descended from the Anglo-Saxon royal family, but he and his two sisters had grown up in exile on the European continent. He was brought back to England in his early teens, a few years before the conquest. Now, Edgar was apparently not a terribly imposing figure. When King Harold died at Hastings, and William began his devastating march towards London, Edgar's supporters rather quickly rushed to meet the conqueror and offer him submission, and Edgar was forced to follow suit. But within a few years, Edgar's resolve stiffened, and he ended up in Scotland at the court of Malcolm Canmore looking for an ally. King Malcolm agreed to marry one of Edgar's sisters, Margaret, and to support Edgar's bid for the English throne. It's very probable that part of the deal would have been a promise that Scotland would receive territory in northern England in return for this assistance. It didn't work out well for Edgar. William was a formidable adversary, and Malcolm paid a heavy price for supporting Edgar. Malcolm had to acknowledge William's overlordship and expel Edgar from Scotland. So Edgar duly went into exile. He had many hair-raising adventures, but he seems to have had 9 lives and died in his bed at the age of 75, never having become King of England. The important thing for our purposes, though, is the marriage between Edgar's sister Margaret and King Malcolm. This marriage was long and lasting. And in fact, the two spouses were so devoted to each other that when Margaret learned of Malcolm's death in battle in 1093, she died herself 3 days later, supposedly of grief. She was renowned for her piety and was canonized in 1250 by the Catholic Church. Now, since Edgar Atheling never married and his other sister, Christina, became a nun, Queen Margaret of Scotland represented the true line of the Anglo-Saxon royal house. So in 1100, William the Conqueror's youngest son, Henry, who had just taken the English throne as Henry I, decided to unite the old Anglo-Saxon claim to the Norman claim with his own by marrying the daughter of Queen Margaret and Malcolm Canmore, Princess Edith. Edith was then renamed Matilda, so that the French-speaking Normans could pronounce her name. So why does this digression into English history matter in a lecture about Scotland? It's because the newly renamed Matilda, the half-Scottish, half-Anglo-Saxon Queen of England, invited her younger brother, David, to hang out at the English court. And while he was there, he became thoroughly Normanized. He absorbed some of the practices that we loosely refer to as feudalism, and he ultimately brought them back to Scotland with him, where, due to the unexpected early deaths of all of his older brothers, he became King of Scotland in 1124 and ruled for nearly 30 years. David admired the Anglo-Norman knights he met at the English court, and in fact, his royal seal depicts him very much as an Anglo-Norman knight. So he invited many of these knights to Scotland and gave them lands and titles. And these knights founded many of the great families of Scotland, including 2 families that would later produce royal Scottish dynasties, the Bruce family, who were originally from Normandy, and the Stuart family, who came from Brittany. And thus, ironically, English culture came to Scotland via another Celtic region. Some of these families assimilated very well into the existing Gaelic-speaking aristocracy of Scotland. But this Anglo-Norman element helped to make French, and later the Scots language, which was closely related to English, more prestigious than Gaelic. And that is one reason why Scots became the country's dominant language rather than Gaelic. So King David was a very anglicized or Normanized Gaelic King of Scotland, and this trend continued over the next century and a half. Scottish kings worked rather ruthlessly to implement English-style primogeniture in the Scottish royal house, No more cousins fighting for the throne as a matter of course. So eager were the kings to stamp out alternate lines of the royal house that in 1229, an infant girl from a junior branch of the family called the McWilliams had her brains dashed out against the column of the Market Cross of the town of Forfar. Although Scotland and England certainly had their ups and downs during this period, most of the 13th century was peaceful enough until the Scottish royal family underwent a dynastic catastrophe in 1286 when King Alexander III died, leaving only a granddaughter who promptly died as well. Now, under the old Celtic conditions of Macbeth's day, there would have just been an old-fashioned civil war to decide which of the 13 throne-worthy men who presented themselves should become king. But the Scots had now become accustomed to following Anglo-Norman-style dynastic rules, so they called in King Edward I of England to mediate among the claimants, who argued their cases based not on competence, but on genealogy. Although it must be said that the strength of their followings was surely a factor in the background all along. Now, of course, asking King Edward of England to choose the King of Scotland was a bit like asking the cat to choose the King of the Mice. He wasn't exactly going to pick the most formidable candidate. He instead chose John Baliol, another scion of a northern French family, instead of a more popular candidate named Robert de Bruce, or Robert Bruce, who was likewise of mixed Anglo-Norman and Celtic ancestry. Baliol was largely unable to stand up to King Edward's efforts to dominate Scotland, and he lost support quickly among the Scottish nobles, who nicknamed him Tomb Tabard. A tabard is a kind of outer garment, and tomb means empty. So they were basically calling the king an empty suit. John Baliol finally did man up, so to speak, and defy Edward, but by then it was too late. And in 1296, Edward marched north, defeated Baliol, and took him captive. Along with the captive king, Edward removed the coronation stone of the Scottish kings from Scone Abbey and installed it at Westminster Abbey, as if to say, Scottish sovereignty is now at an end. We're now up to the events that are rather loosely depicted in the film Braveheart. Let me lay my cards on the table. I am not a huge fan of this film, though I think there are some fascinating aspects to it. The hero of the film is a real historical figure named Sir William Wallace, played by Mel Gibson, who nearly single-handedly takes on the English oppressors of Scotland. And incidentally, Wallace's last name is related to the word Welsh, and it indicates that he probably came from a family in southwestern Scotland that were originally British-speaking. So he represented a late survival of the pre-Celtic population of southern Scotland. Now, there are a lot of problems in Braveheart, but it is true that Wallace did make life very difficult for the English in Scotland for nearly a decade. He defeated them at Stirling Bridge in 1297, though the battle is nothing like what you see in the movie, and he was named Guardian of Scotland. But finally, in 1305, he was captured and executed in a very gruesome fashion, and in fact, the real execution is even worse than we see in the movie. So I will skip the details. At the same time, though, another Robert Bruce, the grandson of the unsuccessful claimant from back in the early 1290s, took over the leadership of the Scottish resistance to English rule after murdering yet another claimant to the throne. And he went on to defeat the English at the Battle of Bannockburn in 1314. And Scotland maintained its independence from England for almost three more centuries, and only became part of Britain in 1603 by a dynastic accident when Queen Elizabeth I died without heirs and left the kingdom to her cousin, James VI of Scotland, who became James I of England. Before I leave Braveheart, I will just point out a couple of its many historical inaccuracies, and I'll confine myself to ones that are directly relevant to the Celtic aspect of Scottish history, because both of them play on modern views of the Celts. In the film, we see lowland Scots wearing tartan cloth, which, as we'll see in a later lecture, is characteristic of the Highlands. The filmmakers seem to think that if we don't see tartan, we won't believe we're in Scotland. William Wallace and his fellow soldiers are also wearing very improbably bright blue war paint, about 1,000 years after the Picts supposedly did so. But again, enough people know about the blue war paint that when we see it in the movie theater, we believe we are in Scotland. There's one more distortion in the film that I find particularly intriguing because it illustrates the pervasive modern view that all Celtic countries are intimately connected to each other. About halfway through the film, we are introduced to the character of Stephen, played by David Patrick O'Hara, an Irishman who rather randomly joins Wallace's merry band of Scottish patriots. This character is entirely invented. Stephen is really there to give the Irish Americans in the audience a dog in this fight. In another sign of pandering to the Irish element, there is a scene in which King Edward describes his plan for an invasion of Scotland. In describing his forces, he refers to the levies from England and Wales, and then he is very careful to refer to his Irish troops as Irish conscripts. It's very important that nobody believe for an instant that any Irish soldier would willingly fight against the Scots. That would mean violating some sort of Celtic solidarity. Now, in actual fact, the Irish troops who fought in Scotland were there on the same terms as any of the other troops. But this distinction between the Irish and the other troops is made in the film in order to set up one of the most famous scenes when the English commanders send their Irish conscripts into battle against the Scots first, as a sort of cannon fodder. But of course, the Irish troops immediately switch sides and fight on behalf of the Scots, their Celtic brethren. This is, of course, complete nonsense. Mel Gibson is trying to create a kind of fake pan-Celtic nationalism that resists the oppression of the evil English Empire. Still, what's intriguing is, despite the fact that the movie's historical inaccuracies were widely recognized and discussed in Scotland at the time, Braveheart has taken on a political salience. There is little doubt that support for Scottish independence has gotten at least a small boost from the movie. There is actually a tiny bit of truth, though, to the idea of a Celtic alliance at the time of Robert Bruce. Bruce knew he was locked in a life-and-death struggle to maintain Scottish independence, and he reached out for allies wherever he could find them. There is some evidence that he was trying, from early on in his reign, to create an alliance with Ireland and Wales. He wrote a letter to the Irish kings in 1306 in which he specifically referred to the common ancestry of the Irish and the Scots. But of course, he did not use the term Celtic. And in 1315, the year after his big victory at the Battle of Bannockburn, Bruce tried to bring such an alliance about. He clearly saw a Scottish invasion of Ireland as a way to cut off the supply of Irish troops and taxes to the English army. Robert Bruce knew Ireland well because his late wife had been the daughter of the Earl of Ulster. In addition, before he became King of Scotland, he spent time hiding out on Rathlin Island off the coast of Ulster. Then, around the time of Bannockburn, Robert Bruce was approached by Donal O'Neill, an Irish ruler who wanted help against the Earl of Ulster, Robert's former father-in-law. The O'Neills were the most illustrious native family in Ireland. They were descended from the famous Niall of the Nine Hostages, and had once ruled most of the northern half of Ireland, but now they were confined to the western part of the province of Ulster. In 1315, in response to O'Neill's plea, Robert Bruce sent his brother, Edward Bruce, to Ireland. It's not clear whether he was trying to create an actual satellite kingdom or merely to cause a diversion, but at any rate, in May of 1315, Edward landed in Ulster and many Irish leaders flocked to join him. He set up his base in Ulster, and then he raided the Midlands and the South. Edward also participated in a ritual of royal inauguration, though not, I hasten to add, along the lurid lines described in the 12th century by Gerald of Wales. So Edward was claiming to be, and he was acknowledged by many to be, King of Ireland. Edward had some successes. He did defeat the Earl of Ulster in the field. He captured the imposing castle of Carrickfergus, the great fortress of the Earls of Ulster. But he could not capture Dublin, so he still could not operate consistently outside of his initial power base in Ulster. Reports of this general lack of progress went home to Scotland, and in 1317, Robert Bruce decided to come in person to try to jumpstart the invasion. Together, the brothers moved south on Dublin, but the city resisted. So they bypassed Dublin and moved south into Munster, where they went up against an Anglo-Irish army, which included one faction of the famous O'Brien family, who were mainly opposing the Bruces because another faction of the O'Briens was backing them. So, as we can see, local Irish rivalries got mapped onto the conflict and led to stalemate, and the Bruces were forced to retreat back to Ulster. Robert was then needed back in Scotland, so he went home, and one guesses he left with some feelings of relief to be shot of the whole quagmire, or perhaps we should say bog. For a year and a half, Edward Bruce basically sat there in Ulster, bottled up, unable to do much of anything. During this period of stalemate in 1317, Donal O'Neill drafted an important document called the Remonstrance of the Princes. It was sent by the Irish princes to Pope John XXII. The remonstrance came about because the Irish lords had a public relations problem. Officially, they were rebels. From the perspective of the rest of Europe, including the church, the Irish princes were supposed to be subjects of the King of England. But now they had switched allegiance and accepted Edward Bruce as king. How could they justify defying the terms of the papal bull Laudabiliter, which had authorized the English invasion of Ireland back in the 12th century? Well, the remonstrance tries to explain, and in effect it tries to have it both ways. First, it denies that Laudabiliter is valid. This was a risky strategy because, face it, it is not easy to get a pope to overturn something that his predecessor did. For our purposes, though, the more interesting aspect of this remonstrance is the fact that it draws heavily on one of our favorite texts, the Book of Invasions, the amalgam of origin myths about the Irish that dates back in some form, at least, to the 8th century. The Irish princes in the remonstrance cite their descent from the Milesians of Spain and thus deny that England has any authority over them. They're clearly making this a usable past. What is the result of the remonstrance? Nothing. The Pope ignored it, and the rebel princes were in fact later excommunicated. Finally, in the fall of 1318, fed up with the situation, Edward Bruce decided on a last big throw of the dice. He moved south again and came to battle at Fochart, near Dundalk, on the coast, right on what is now the border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. But he was defeated and died in the battle. And that was the end of the Bruce invasion. It failed for many reasons, but one of the most important was the fact that there was no real pan-Celtic alliance. There wasn't even a pan-Irish alliance. Edward Bruce had a powerful ally in Donal O'Neill, but Donal could not speak for the lords of the rest of Ireland. They saw no reason automatically to back this invader. Wherever there was a faction fight within Ireland, the factions would split into pro-Bruce and anti-Bruce parties, and that division doomed the invasion. But the Bruce invasion of Ireland probably had a direct impact on one of the most important documents in Scottish history, the famous Declaration of Arbroath, which was written in 1320, only 3 years after the remonstrance of the Irish princes. It, too, was directed at the Pope to explain the fact that the Scots were supporting their king, Robert Bruce, who had been excommunicated for murdering his rival for the throne back in 1306. The Declaration of Arbroath starts by explaining the proud heritage of the Scots leading all the way back to Spain, and before that to the Mediterranean and to Scythia. All of this is borrowed directly from the Irish Book of Invasions. so it's highly likely that the Irish and Scottish intellectuals had been talking to each other about the best way to project an image of independence to the Pope. The Declaration of Arbroath, however, was more successful than the remonstrance of the Irish princes, since Pope John XXII did eventually lift Robert Bruce's excommunication. So in these two documents, we do see a consciousness of common descent for the Irish and the Scots, even though it is being claimed by a Scottish royal family that is only partly Celtic by ancestry. But we also see that Scotland has been brought into the dynastic norms of the wider European society. And that is what brings me finally back to Macbeth. In the wake of the Wars of Independence against England, there was an explosion of Scottish historical writing. In around 1375, a long poem was written in Scots to commemorate the achievements of Robert Bruce. About 100 years later, another poem was written by somebody calling himself Blind Harry about the deeds of William Wallace. This is a far less factual account than the Bruce poem, and it served as the basis for the novel that eventually turned into the film Braveheart. At the same time, a number of Scottish authors decided that it was important to tell the whole story of Scottish history from the beginning. And where they didn't have a lot of details, say for the reign of Macbeth, they made them up. But they did so for very specific purposes. In the case of Macbeth, it was useful to go back to the last place where there was a major dynastic break and paint the loser in a bad light and the winner in a good light. So Macbeth is no longer simply the winner in an ordinary faction fight, the long-lived patron of the poor, but rather the usurper who murders children. So the rules got changed on Macbeth 300 years after he died. He would have been very surprised to come back to life in the late 14th century and realize that his reputation had been trashed. In fact, it got worse and worse over time as each generation of Scottish writers developed the legend of Macbeth, adding the witches and all sorts of other nefarious elements to the story. Shakespeare's Macbeth was nearly all created by the Scots themselves. So I suppose one irony of Scottish history in the Middle Ages is how complicated the relationship was between Celtic tradition and the English world that the Scots were always forced to confront, sometimes willingly, as in the case of the borrowing of Anglo-Norman noble expertise, but sometimes not, as in the interference at the time of the Wars of Independence. A case in point, one of the most famous works by that quintessentially English writer, William Shakespeare, written for the first Scottish king of England, is known as the Scottish Play.
Lecture 19, Politics and Literature in Wales.
Welcome back. In an earlier lecture, I talked a little bit about English incursions into Wales in the 11th century. In this lecture, I want to tell the story of Wales from the 11th century down to about the 15th century. I'll talk about the tangled politics within Wales itself and about the complicated relationship between Wales and England that culminated in the conquest of Wales. Finally, I'll say something about the fascinating literature of medieval Wales. Let's start with some basic facts about Welsh society. Wales, like Ireland, was very culturally unified, but it was politically divided, partly due to its geography. The terrain is quite mountainous. And although the mountains are not all that high, the topography is challenging enough to make it easy for authority to be fragmented into small units, perhaps as small in some cases as a single valley. Nevertheless, there were several large centers of power, or what we might call petty kingdoms. But the ability of these kings or lords to control their followers was very tenuous, and persistent succession struggles continually worked against the creation of political stability. The political center of gravity could shift according to the personal abilities of each successive ruler. Throughout the Middle Ages, Wales was divided along geographic lines roughly into thirds. In the south, there were a series of small kingdoms ranging from Dyfed in the southwest to Gwent in the southeast. In central Wales, the dominant power was the kingdom of Powys. The most important lordship, however, was Gwynedd in the northwest, where several generations of rulers were able to exert a loose overlordship over many of the other Welsh princes. It was Gwynedd that would produce the closest thing we ever see to a native ruler over all of Wales. Of course, the most important geographic fact in Welsh history has been the relationship with its larger and richer neighbor to the east. The history of relations between England and Wales is long and complicated. It goes back to the period of the Germanic settlements, when the area of Celtic speech slowly receded westward across the country. As I said in my lecture about Britain after the fall of Rome, a more or less stable situation developed whereby Celtic-speaking rulers were confined to the area we now know as Wales, but there was still considerable cross-border raiding between Wales and the various English kingdoms. It was to defend against such raids that King Offa of the English Kingdom of Mercia built his famous dike in the 8th century, large sections of which can still be seen today. In the subsequent few centuries, there was the occasional serious incident when Welsh rulers would cause trouble on the English side of the border, or vice versa, but these raids were usually rather ephemeral. The dynamic changed considerably with the Norman conquest of England in 1066. Under the early Norman kings, English settlers made inroads in Wales, intending not just to seize plunder or teach the natives a lesson, but rather to settle permanently. The Normans had some lasting successes, especially in the south, where they created a colony in what is now Pembrokeshire, that ultimately provided some of the most prominent members of the contingent that embarked on the conquest of Ireland in the 12th century. But the Normans had never really conquered the whole place, and in fact, some of their early gains in North Wales in the late 11th century were wiped out when the powerful ruler of Gwynedd, Griffith ap Conan, defeated and killed the Norman lord, Robert of Friedland. The Welsh also drove out the Norman-imposed Bishop of Bangor, Hervey Le Breton, who was forced to beg King Henry I of England for another job. He ended up as bishop of the new see of Ely all the way in eastern England, as far away from Wales as he could get. Wales proved a tougher nut to crack than England had, in part because political authority was so divided. Whereas in 1066 the Normans had been able to make significant gains just by defeating King Harold of England, in Wales, the ruler of Powys did not feel bound to follow the lead of the ruler of Gwynedd, or vice versa. Of course, whenever the political situation in England was difficult, the Welsh tended to take advantage. But the division within Wales cut both ways. Since the Welsh fought with each other as much as they did with the English, they had great difficulty in unifying sufficiently to see off the English threat for good. Periodically, though, as I mentioned, Wales did produce leaders who made a run at establishing hegemony over the whole country. The most important came from Gwynedd, and I'll just talk about two of them. I'm afraid they are both named Llywelyn. The first is named Llywelyn ap Iorwerth, which means Llywelyn, son of Iorwerth. A quick word about Welsh naming practices. The word ap in Llywelyn ap Iorwerth comes from map, which means son. And through one of those initial mutations that the Celtic languages are famous for, the M disappears and we're just left with ap. Incidentally, this is one of the places where you can see the difference between P-Celtic and Q-Celtic languages the most clearly. The word map is the exact equivalent of the Irish word mac, as you find in countless Irish and Scottish surnames. But back to Llywelyn ap Iorwerth. He was also known as Llywelyn Vawr, or Llywelyn the Great. How did he get that nickname? By extending his overlordship over much of Wales, and by dealing with the English on virtually an equal footing. Llywelyn's story is a good one, because it brings up a theme that recurs in Welsh history. We have in Wales the phenomenon that was characteristic of all the Celtic-speaking regions, the lack of clear rules for the succession. As we saw in the lecture on medieval Scotland, one of the ways in which the Scots achieved a fairly stable political system was by adopting English-style primogeniture. That didn't happen in Wales. Llywelyn was the grandson of a previous king of Gwynedd, but he had to fight two of his uncles and then a cousin to establish himself as ruler, and he was never entirely safe from challenges by members of his own family. Still, Llywelyn must have been a man of great charisma and personal authority, because he did manage to assert his hegemony over most of the native rulers in Wales. Though this hegemony was fairly loose, nothing like the English king's power over his vassals and officials. One of the clearest signs of Llywelyn's authority was the fact that he made a peace treaty with King John of England in 1200, and he even married John's illegitimate daughter, Joan. This brings me to an interesting aspect of Welsh society that also parallels what we see in Ireland, namely the fact that the rules of marriage were a little different from those in England. In Wales and Ireland, the marital status of the parents was less important in determining whether a child had inheritance rights. The key question was whether the father acknowledged paternity. The church was attempting to change this, and in fact, Llywelyn himself had gotten the church to back him in his struggle against his uncles by claiming that the uncles were illegitimate. But it was still true that legitimacy or illegitimacy wasn't really seen as that big a deal. And thus, it was a pretty major coup for Llywelyn to marry even the illegitimate daughter of the English king. Llywelyn, though, was trying to change the rules and insist on legitimate status for heirs in Wales. In fact, he was trying to normalize the inheritance system so that it looked more like the English system, very much along the lines of what the Scottish kings had been doing since the late 11th century. The idea in both Wales and Scotland was to try to make the rules clearer and also to conform to the customs of the Anglo-Norman world so that it was easier to get along with their neighbors. In a certain sense, Llywelyn was trying to at least partly assimilate Wales to English norms. The relationship between Llywelyn and King John of England did not work out well, however, and here we see another important theme in Welsh history come into play, disunity among the Welsh rulers. Llywelyn seems to have allied himself with the English noble family of De Breuses, which held lands along the Welsh border. But then the De Breuses fell out with King John, and Llywelyn was drawn into the dispute. King John's supporter, the Earl of Chester, then attacked Gwynedd. In 1211, King John invaded Gwynedd personally. And here's the kicker. John was supported by most of the other princes of Wales, who were trying to ally with John in order to put Llywelyn in his place and preserve their own autonomy. John was able to seize a number of hostages from Llywelyn. These hostages were adolescent sons of Llywelyn's major supporters, and John planned to hold them to guarantee that Llywelyn would keep the peace. But the Welsh ruler nevertheless defied John, so the following year, in 1212, John planned a second invasion, and he had even begun executing the hostages when, we learn from one account, a message arrived from John's daughter Joan, Llywelyn's wife, warning him that if he invaded Wales again, his own nobles, the English nobles, would rise up and overthrow him. I mentioned briefly that John had fallen out with his vassals, the De Breuses family. Well, the De Breuses were not John's only domestic enemies, and in this case, John's difficulty was Llywelyn's opportunity. John was quickly hurtling towards the confrontation with his barons that would culminate in him being forced to accept Magna Carta in 1215. And Llywelyn allied himself with these rebellious barons. He captured the English border town of Shrewsbury in support of the rebels' efforts to force John into a settlement. So John's Welsh invasion was abandoned. And a few years later, the text of the Great Charter would specifically call on John to release the remaining Welsh hostages, including one of Llywelyn's illegitimate sons. Llywelyn went on to rule Gwynedd and to dominate Wales until his death in 1240. He certainly earned his nickname of Llywelyn the Great. The second Llywelyn I want to talk about is his grandson, Llywelyn ap Gruffydd. He was in fact the son of Llywelyn the Great's illegitimate son, Gruffydd, the hostage who was released under the terms of Magna Carta. Llywelyn the Great had passed over Griffith in the succession in favor of his legitimate son, Dafydd, whose mother was Princess Joan. And almost inevitably, after the death of their father, the two half-brothers fought each other for the rulership of Gwynedd. The English king, Henry III, used this internecine dispute in Wales to his advantage to keep the Welsh at each other's throats, and it was in a sense only a happy accident that by 1246, Griffith's son Llywelyn was the last man standing. I'm somewhat giving away the ending, though, when I tell you that his nickname is Llywelyn Ein Llyw Olaf, which translates roughly as Llywelyn the Last, as in the last Prince of Wales. Some of the same themes we saw during the reign of the first Llywelyn also characterize the reign of his grandson. One of these is the fact that Wales always did well when England was in political turmoil. King Henry III of England faced a major baronial revolt in the 1250s and 60s, and Llywelyn allied with the king's main opponent, Simon de Montfort, though Simon was ultimately killed in battle in 1265. And we see a repeat of the fluctuating alliances between the English king and the other rulers of Wales, who were not always thrilled about one of their number being first among equals. So how did Llywelyn ap Gruffydd become Llywelyn the Last? The final conquest of Wales came about when Llywelyn clashed with the son and successor of King Henry III, Edward I, over the feudal homage that Llywelyn supposedly owed to the English king under the terms of the Treaty of Montgomery, signed in 1267. Relations between Edward and Llywelyn were not improved when Llywelyn married Simon de Montfort's daughter, Eleanor, who, by the way, was Edward's first cousin, since Simon de Montfort was married to King Henry's sister. It is hard to exaggerate how closely intertwined all of these people were with each other. King Edward saw this marriage as a power move by the Welsh ruler and tried to prevent it from taking place. Throughout the 1270s, there were repeated clashes between Edward and Llywelyn. The English king made use of Llywelyn's resentful and treacherous younger brother, Dafydd, who had actually plotted to assassinate Llywelyn as a means of fomenting discontent in Gwynedd. Dafydd was quite willing to go along with Edward's plan to conquer much of Wales and set Dafydd up as ruler of a small remaining territory. By 1277, Llywelyn had been forced to concede large tracts of Welsh land to English rule. The end came in 1282, and it was precipitated by Dafydd. Many of the Welsh lords who were now effectively under English lordship due to Edward's previous conquests thought better of their support for English rule once it became clear that Edward would be a harsh overlord, and Dafydd himself precipitated a rebellion against the English. Llywelyn felt obliged to support his brother, God knows why, and he was forced into a war that he was ill-prepared to fight. In December 1282, Llywelyn was killed in battle, and his head was displayed in London for the next 15 years. After Llywelyn's death, King Edward made it his business to conquer all of Wales once and for all, and he made sure of his conquest by building a series of impressive castles, many of which still stand today. If you look at the way the castles are distributed on a map, it is quite clear that they were planned to place a kind of cordon around Gwynedd. But you also see some of them extending down the westward coast of Wales. They range today from very ruined to quite well-preserved. For example, Aberystwyth Castle is pretty ruinous now, as is Flint Castle. But at the other end of the spectrum is Rhuddlan's Castle, which is pretty intact. Finally, I want to mention Caernarfon Castle, where Edward I's son, Edward, was born in 1284. He later became Edward II. This young prince became the first heir to the English throne to be named Prince of Wales, a tradition that continues to this day. There's a later story that after the conquest of Wales, Edward I promised the Welsh that he would give them a prince born in Wales who spoke no English. It was, of course, a trick, because he really meant his infant son, Edward, who, at the time, spoke no language of any kind. Incidentally, when the current holder of the title, Prince Charles, was preparing to be inaugurated as Prince of Wales, he took a crash course in Welsh. I have no idea how much Welsh he remembers today. The story of King Edward's trick on the Welsh is probably apocryphal, but it does say something about relations between the Welsh and the English. It was a pretty thorough, brutal conquest. Of all of England's attempts to subdue the lands of the Celtic fringe, the efforts against Wales had the most success. Those castles did the trick. Wales still retains a separate cultural identity, but the political integration with England has been quite complete. I'd like to make a quick digression here into modern British politics. The question of the status of the Prince of Wales in the modern period is quite interesting because of the recent changes made to the long-standing British rules of succession that traditionally preferred male children to female children in the royal line. It used to be the case that all the sons of a monarch came first in the line of succession before any of the daughters, even if the daughters were older. For example, the oldest child of Queen Victoria was Princess Victoria, but the heir to the throne was her younger brother, Albert Edward, who became Prince of Wales and later succeeded to the throne as Edward VII. 4 decades later, King George VI had 2 daughters and no sons, so the question of preferring a younger brother to an older sister did not arise. Then both Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Charles produced male children first, so again there was no question. In the meantime, of course, the views of society about relations between the genders had undergone a dramatic shift, and it no longer seemed natural for males to be preferred to females. When Prince Charles's first son, Prince William, married Catherine Middleton in 2011, the British Parliament faced an impending situation. What if the first child of the royal couple was a girl followed by a boy? Would the British public stand for it if the younger boy displaced the older girl? It was decided that something needed to be done, and a new law was passed to change the rules and get rid of the gender preference altogether. Parliament took the same opportunity to get rid of the rule that the heir to the throne cannot marry a Catholic, which was left over from a period when England was afraid of domination by Catholic countries on the continent of Europe. The reason all of this is interesting from a Welsh perspective is that while there have been plenty of princesses of Wales who were the wives of princes of Wales, there has technically never been a princess of Wales in her own right. When Queen Elizabeth was the heir, it was briefly proposed that she be named Princess of Wales, but this never went anywhere. Supposedly, Elizabeth herself was not keen on the idea. But in the future, provided the monarchy continues, there may very well be a Princess of Wales rather than a Prince of Wales. So what happened after the conquest of Edward I in Wales? The country was suppressed remarkably quickly. There were a few uprisings, but nothing major until the revolt of Owain Glyndwr in 1400, made famous in Shakespeare's play Henry IV, Part 1. Here the figure of Owen is seen as rather flighty and unreliable, obsessed with magic and prophecy. Though in fact, the real Owain was a substantial figure. He was descended from the native princes of Powys in central Wales, and he entered into a major conspiracy with 2 English rebel lords, with the idea that the 3 men would divide the island of Britain 3 ways. Owain's 2 English confederates were defeated at the Battle of Shrewsbury in 1403, but Owain managed to hang on against the English until 1409, when he was forced into hiding. He was last spotted in 1412, and there is a report of his death in 1416, but since it is not known where he died or where his body is, a legend grew up that, like King Arthur, Owain would come again to restore the fortunes of the Welsh people. I mentioned that Shakespeare does not treat Owain very kindly, but Shakespeare didn't look down on all the Welsh. One of his most interesting minor characters, in my opinion, is the Welsh Captain Llewellyn from the play Henry V. It's a play filled with scoundrels and characters who are ambivalent at best, but Llewellyn is one of the only truly honorable men in the play. and Henry himself claims Welsh identity in the play. "For I am Welsh, you know." And this is due to his birth at Monmouth in Wales. It's interesting to note that while the English have entertained some rather vicious stereotypes about the Irish and about the Highland Scots, they've never been quite as negatively disposed towards the Welsh. I think one reason for this is that the Welsh were conquered comparatively early in the history of England. Any fears the English may have had about the Welsh were laid to rest long ago. Still, Wales remained undeveloped in comparison to England, and it seemed to the English like the back of beyond. And this remoteness led to the rise of an expression that sounds like it is an ethnic slur against the Welsh, but it really isn't. Back in the 18th century, when debtors' prisons still existed, people who were afraid of being arrested for debt sometimes fled to Wales, where it was harder to track people down. Some of the people who did this were actually bookmakers who could not pay off their bets. They would flee to Wales, and this was called Welshing on a bet. Nowadays, this refers generally to people who refuse or fail to pay their debts of honor. So it's not actually an insult against Welsh people's honesty, but it is a reminder that Wales was seen as a place to go to when you needed to disappear. Let's return for the remainder of this lecture to Welsh literature produced during the Middle Ages. The corpus of medieval Welsh literature is not as extensive as the Irish one, but it has arguably been far more influential on European literature as a whole. One remarkable thing to note about this literature is that much of what we have is preserved in only two manuscripts. The White Book of Rhyddech, so-called because it is bound in white leather, which was written in southwest Wales in about 1350, and the Red Book of Hergest, this one bound in red leather, which was written after 1382 along the border with England. And incidentally, J.R.R. Tolkien named his fictional manuscript that supposedly contained the Lord of the Rings stories, the Red Book of Westmarch, after the Red Book of Hergest. So what is this corpus of Welsh literature? The oldest literary texts we have are poems from the early Middle Ages. They include some beautiful laments for the loss of love and youth, as well as the epic poem The Gododdin, which I talked about in several earlier lectures as part of the literary legacy of the Old North, the regions of northern Britain that had once been Celtic-speaking. Much of what was produced from the 11th century onwards consists of praise poetry for the Welsh princes. Just as we see in Ireland and Scotland, Welsh princes commissioned poetry and historical texts to boost their standing among their subjects and fellow rulers. And by the way, it's not unheard of for rulers in non-Celtic-speaking areas to commission flattering literary works. It's just that in the Celtic regions, this is taken to an extreme, and even relatively minor lords did it. Some of this flattery was really kind of absurd. You might have long poems praising a guy who, at the most, controlled one valley. But this is a poor society that largely operates on face-to-face contacts and word of mouth, and praise is one of the major lubricants of the system. The most influential works of Welsh medieval literature, though, are the four anonymous prose tales, known collectively as the Mabinogi, commonly, but not technically correctly, referred to as the Mabinogion, as well as the tales that relate to King Arthur, which I talk about in another lecture. These tales became popular in France and then throughout Europe, and they still influence popular culture to this day. The Mabinogi is a puzzling work if you just come to it cold. The four tales are often referred to as the four branches, but if you read them, you're not exactly sure what they are branches of. They're interrelated. There are some characters that occur in more than one of the stories, but the relationship between them doesn't seem especially close. I'll just run through some quick plot summaries of the first two branches to give you a sense of what we're talking about. In the first branch, which is called Puich, Prince of Dyved, the title character, Puich, does a service for the lord of the underworld, Arawn, and is rewarded with a mysterious supernatural bride named Rhiannon, who rides a horse that can never be caught up with, even when it seems to be merely walking. Rhiannon and Puich have many adventures before they can finally marry, but Rhiannon eventually bears a son, Pryderi. The core of the story is the disappearance of the infant Pryderi, for which Rhiannon is initially blamed, but Pryderi is eventually restored to his rightful place and succeeds Pwyll in ruling Dyfed. In the second